Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Seats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The best way to store chocolates that we make in a store like mine, the best way to store them is in your stomach because they don't age very well.
Right.
So eat them fresh.
This week, Jacques Torres, a.k.a. Mr. Chocolate, one of the greatest nicknames ever, is in the house. Jacques, good to have you.
Ed, thank you very much.
Jacques is perhaps the most highly decorated pastry chef and chocolatier of his time. Chocolatier, do you say chocolatier?
Chocolatier is good. I take it.
Chocolatier, okay. And in many ways, also one of the most influential. He's won James Beard Awards. He's in Who's Who in Food and Wine in America. He's even gotten the highest honor you can get in France, and correct my pronunciation here, Chevalier de la Légion d'honneur.
Perfect. Parfait. Ooh-wee. Parfait.
He has a huge bean-to-bar plant not far from Sirius Seats World Headquarters, and he's even opened a chocolate museum called Choco Story New York Chocolate Museum and Experience with Jacques Torres. Welcome to Special Sauce, Jacques Torres.
Happy to be here. Merci.
There's so many things to talk about, but first I want to hear about life at the Torres family table growing up.
I grew up in the south of France in a little town called Bandol. Bandol is in Provence, in between Toulon and Marseille. In Bandol, we make wine. And we take naps in the afternoon. That's pretty much.
That's pretty much what we do over there. In Bandol, you make wine and take naps.
That's it.
That's a great town.
So little markets. You can imagine a little Provençal village on the shore of the Mediterranean, and a beautiful little markets. And life is pretty, let's say, sweet there.
Was your mom a good cook?
My mom was. I will say a family cook. My mom was doing, we was three boys and my dad. So my mom had to do those big dishes, you know, the beans with maybe sausage or chicken. And then the next day she had some rice to it and that became something else. And mom used to do those big dishes and also a little bit of pastry. So she loved to cook pie and very simple pastries. She was very good to make that rice, you know, cooking milk with a little bit of cinnamon and sugar on top. Ooh, I love that. I still remember that those dishes. So, yeah, she was a fairly good cook.
And was food an important part of everyday life in the Torres household?
Yes. I mean, I think that food was important for a few reasons. First, I mean, you need food to live. But living where I grew up, ingredients are amazing. I just came back. I was last week in Bandol, and I'm always amazed by the quality of the product. When you go to the market and you look at the melon de Cavaillon, or you look at the peaches, or the fig. Now the figs are very fresh, you know, the Black Mission free figs, the grapes. I mean, French are taking those ingredients very seriously, and Provence is a place where beautiful fruits and vegetables grow. So yes, you know, I grew up with amazing surrounding of good product, and fortunately our neighbor was also the fisherman of the town. So every day he leave a little, you know, basket of fish that maybe an octopus or maybe a cattlefish was eating during the night, and he was not presentable. So he was leaving those fish in front of our door, and so every day we have beautiful fish.
What a great neighbor!
I mean,
and is that,
yes.
You know? And I know you're a very serious fisherman. Is that where it came from?
I love to be on the water. I love to fish because when I grew up, I was going fishing.
Yeah,
I didn't catch much, but I was going fishing, and I love the water. I love the boats.
Dave Pasternak says, "I hate fishing. I love catching."
I love both. It doesn't matter.
So did you get interested in helping your mom in the kitchen? Like, how did you get interested in food?
So, look, I think that I came to food because I want to be a craftsman. My dad was a craftsman. He was a carpenter. My brother was a chef. My other brother was a carpenter. I know that I will not be on an academic profession. I will be more on a profession where I create things with my hands. So at one point I want to be a carpenter, another point I want to be a diver, I want to be different things. And then age came for me to start looking at what I want to be. I was 14, 15 years old. And my brother advised me, say, look, there is no good restaurant, but there is a good pastry shop. Try that. So I give my day off at school to that pastry shop to try. And I fall in love. The
really?
First day that I try that, I'm thinking, oh my God, that sticky, sweet stuff. I want to do that for the rest of my life. And I became a pastry chef that way.
Wow. And how long did you, so you worked there on your day off in high school?
Yeah. And then at 16 years old, I start what we call an apprenticeship for 2 years. And 2 years later, I get graduated.
And where were you apprenticing?
In Bandol, in the Bandol. Little town of Bandol, in a little pastry shop that still exists called La Frangipane. And I still visit them and still go get my croissant when I'm in vacation. And still, they still do a beautiful job there. And, you know, when I go back, on time and remember, you know, every morning at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, go to work. And the smell on the morning, the smell of the fermented dough, working with that silent, nobody talk in the morning when you're in pastry shop, and just the radio is there. And I remember those moments of learning and I go back to it.
And what did you love about it?
I love the fact that you start and you finish something in the same day or in the same couple of days. You know, when you build a house, it will take months or years sometimes to make a building. So you never, you don't have that satisfaction of an accomplished job all the time because it takes so long to do something. But when you're a pastry chef, you start and you finish something and you can look at it. Pretty much every day you finish things.
Yeah.
And it's that satisfaction of a job well done. And imagine, you can also eat it. You cannot eat a house. You can eat pastry.
No, it's funny. Kenji Lopez-All talks about that's why he started experimenting in food. His father's a famous microbiology professor, but it takes him years to learn whether his experiments
yes.
come to fruition. And he loved the fact that in food, it's like in 2 hours, like, is it good or is it not good?
And you're definitely right. In pastry, it might be a little bit longer. You know, we start croissant the day before, as an example. But the next day when they come out of the oven, every day they're a little bit different. It's a live product, you know, the fermentation and all those things. But every day you have that satisfaction and that smell and that beauty of, I mean, beauty for me, okay? I find that beautiful. Things coming off the oven and make people happy. That's another thing. You make people happy every day. And, you know, oh, my God, you know, I love that. I love the fact that I can see what I do. I have a satisfaction of well done day and making people happy.
That's a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing.
So you graduate from the apprenticeship program.
Yes, when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then right away, I work for almost a year in a little village next to Bandol called La Cadière d'Azur. And I was the best pastry chef in that village because I was the only one.
So, I knew you were going to say that. You didn't even have to tell me that.
Yeah, La Cadière d'Azur is a very small village that was a bakery who has someone working in pastry, and that was me. And I kind of experiment a lot of things there. I did love my time there. And I work at La Cadière d'Azur for 1 year. And then the army called me. You know, in France, you have to go to the army for 1 year. So I accomplished my duty of 1 year in the military. And then from there, my girlfriend at the time was in Nice, a little bit more east. So I decided to go work in Nice. So I show up in that, to me, that was a big town, even if it's a pretty small town compared to New York. So I went to Nice and I was looking for a job. And we was walking in front of that gorgeous hotel, Hotel Negresco in the Promenade des Anglais. And I kind of tell her, I say, look, I bet you, I don't know what was the bet, but I bet you so-and-so that are going to go inside and are going to ask for a job. And you don't do that in France. You don't go to one of those palaces
and knock on the door.
And knock on the door. You don't do that. But you know me, I'm with my 20 and full of myself. I went through the front door and I asked for a job. And the gentleman tell me, you don't come to this door. You have to go behind the hotel. You will find that door and you go in. And you talk to Mr. Charpentier, I remember his name, and Mr. Charpentier will let you know. So I went around the hotel, meet Monsieur Charpentier, and tell him that I was looking for a position in pastry. He take me to the kitchen, and I meet a gentleman called Jacques Maximin. The famous chef. And Jacques Maximin, I will always remember that, was in a little office with his shirt open all the way to his belly button, cigarettes on his hands, and a full ashtray next to him. And he look at me, say, "What do you want?" And I tell him, I say, "You know, I'm looking for a job." "Where? On what?" I say, "Pastry. I come back from the army and I'm looking for a job." And he look at me and he say, "You see behind you the kitchen?" And I say, "Yes." He say, "I have, I don't know, 20, 40 cooks there." He say, "If you're good, I keep you. If you're not good, you're out." And again, I was full of myself and I'm thinking, why do we aggress me? You know, I don't even know who he was. And he was a big deal. And I tell him, "Fine, try me." He say, "Okay, come back in an hour with your uniform." So I go back out and I told my girlfriend, I say, "I need to buy a uniform." He hired me. So right away, we went to a store, I buy a uniform, came back and start an 8 years career, which certainly was the longest time that the pastry chef worked with Jacques Maximin, 8 years.
And by the time you left, I assume you were the head pastry chef.
And I became the head pastry chef actually pretty fast. Lucky me, that was not really a strong pastry chef there. And I learned a lot. I became a meilleur ouvrier de France, or best craftsman in my profession, 6 years later. And 8 years later, this is when I leave the Negresco to come to America.
And what's the most valuable lesson you learned? In 8 years, a long time. You don't just make pastry and run, do you?
Pastry is not something that you can put on a frying pan, cook, and serve. You have to make what we call the mise en place, all the preparation. And you can assemble things maybe at last minute, but it's a lot of preps to do a dish or to do a dessert or a cake, of course. And yes, I stay a long time. I think I work in only 4 places in my whole career. I didn't work in a lot of places. I always stay quite a bit. And the first, I think the most important things that I learned there was don't settle for mediocrity. Never, never, never settle for mediocrity. So it can be the ingredients. They have to be impeccable. And you can imagine in Nice, products are beautiful. Techniques have to be very, very good. And, you know, that was a beautiful place. I mean, we had the rich and famous coming to this hotel. And this is where I stay 8 years and learn a lot.
And did anyone say that to you? Don't settle for mediocrity, Jacques? Or is that just what you developed on your own?
No. Maxime always mentioned mediocrity and always say habits is dangerous because habits a lot of time bring mediocrity. So he was afraid of habits. You know, that's something that you always say, doing every day the same thing is dangerous because what's happening is a lot of time it's called incremental degradation. You do something a little bit less good and a little bit less good and a little bit less good, but you don't see it. It's no difference. But after 1 year, 2 years, then it's a big difference.
Yeah.
So he was afraid of that. And I never settled I never let mediocrity come in between me and my profession. And I think that's very important.
And I assume you learned to be precise in a way that all great pastry chefs.
Yes, I mean
there's not a lot of room for improvisation when you're making plated desserts or pastries.
You know what I learned is that into that precision, there is a certain percentage of playground. So let's say that you are making bread, and bread for 1 kilogram of flour, you're going to put, let's say, 22 grams of salt. But that 22 grams of salt can go to 26 and can go to 18. So now you have almost 10 grams,
to play
grams
with.
To play with. And that's only with the salt. Sugar, it's another story. If the dough aged more, then the sugar became yeast, so you can put a little bit more sugar. So into that precision, you can play. So I learn how much I can play and how much I can make those recipes mine by changing them the way that I'm going to work and changing them the way that the customer wants them. So I think that's what's important in pastry. Learn how much you can play into those numbers that don't supposed to move. And then you can come with your own things.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned after 8 years, you came to America. Was that by design? Were you feeling restless? Did you feel that America was another frontier to conquer? I mean, like, what was driving you to America?
Yes, to all the above that you mentioned. In 1986, 6 years after starting at the Negresco, I won that competition in France, that the highest recognition for craftsmen. It's called MOF, Best Craftsman in Your Profession. So I won that when I was 26.
That's pretty young.
It's very young. And usually you get that title more as a recognition of your career than at the beginning of your career. So when I get that recognition, I realize, oh my God, what's next now? I cannot go and take a class anymore because who is giving the class? There are people like me. There are people who has that title. So I cannot go sit on a class because I am an MOF. So
sounds dirty. You're an MOF?
So yes, yeah, sound dirty. Then I'm thinking, okay, so opening a business. But I'm too young. I don't want to get stuck on a business. So what do I do? America, I love America. I mean,
had you ever been? You just love the idea.
I came a couple of times and I did some little work there and I love it. I love the spirits, I love the people, I just love America. So take a couple suitcase, meet a friend who was a chef at the time for the Ritz-Carlton in Rancho Mirage. His name is Jean-Pierre Dubré. I'm still friend with him. And Jean-Pierre hired me to become the pastry chef and the corporate pastry chef for the Ritz-Carlton at the time. So I came during Thanksgiving, if I remember, and then I came back beginning of the year in 1988, and I start to work at the Ritz-Carlton in Rancho Mirage. So you can imagine from Provence to Rancho Mirage, California, and again I fall in love with Rancho and the way that people live there. Over there you can, you know, you rent an apartment in a complex, but you have a swimming pool, you have jacuzzi, you have a tennis court, you have a place to watch TV, and I was 28, I was full of girls, you know, I love it. So I start to live in that, in those apartment complex and work for the Ritz-Carlton. And I just love it. The weather. I remember that I buy a motorcycle right away when I arrive, and every day that I get up, there was a blue sky and a beautiful sun. And I'm thinking, this is paradise. I mean, this is unbelievable. So I love it. I love Rancho Mirage. I stay there for 6 months. And then Ritz-Carlton sent me to Atlanta. I was not crazy about it, but I learned to love Atlanta. Atlanta is also an interesting city. People are so nice in the South. So, you know, I work in Atlanta for another 6 months. And then Daniel Boulud called me when I was in Atlanta, telling me that he heard about me and he's looking for a pastry chef at Le Cirque. And I tell Daniel, I say, look, I don't like big city and New York is not for me. And then Alain Ducasse called me and told me, you cannot, you know, I know Alain Ducasse from the South of France. And he told me, say, Jacques, you cannot say no to Sirio and Daniel like that. You have to at least go to New York. So I fly to New York, meet Sirio Maccioni, the owner of Le Cirque, and Daniel. And Sirio convinced me to drop Atlanta and come to New York. So I put my motorcycle and my couple suitcase into a van, and I drive from Atlanta to New York.
Wow.
And this is a funny story. When I arrived to New York, I remember to come from Jersey side and to see Manhattan in front of me. And I really experienced what the Big Apple, you know, the Big Apple in your throat is, that type of, I don't know, heaviness that you get in your chest when you see this city. But at that time, there was no Waze or there was no GPS. So, crazy me, I cross Manhattan not even knowing, and I find myself in Queens looking for Le Cirque. So what I did, I stopped my van. That was a yellow van, I remember that. I stopped the van, and I went to a cab. I stopped a cab, and I asked the cabbie, I say, how much he will take me to that address? And I show him the address of Le Cirque. And he said, about $20. I say, okay, so I give you $20. You go over there, but don't lose me. I will follow you with my van. He said, no problem. And I remember to be a driver maniac driving behind this cab for him to not lose me on the 59 Bridge, and he take me in front of Le Cirque.
That's
this
hilarious.
Is how I find Le Cirque.
And you stayed there for a long time.
Almost 12 years, yes.
12 years. Almost. You really don't make pastry and run, do you? You really...
Look, if I like where I work, if I get what I want and what I need, more what I need than what I want, why moving? I mean, there was so much things to learn at Le Cirque. I mean, the who is who, the what American love, the way to work with American staff, but also American customer. What do they want? What do they love to eat? What do they hate? And so I was really experiencing, you know, a lot of things there. And it took me all those years. And I remember that in before 2000, my dad passed away. And that was something happened in my head. I don't know exactly, but that's when I say, you know what? I have to stop my career at Le Cirque. I give pretty much all I have. You know, when you feel a little bit empty, and maybe because of the situation, maybe because I was a little bit empty. I say, you know, I need to change. I need a change in my life. So I decide that I'm going to stop working in restaurant and I'm going to open a small business. At that time, I was thinking it going to be a business to cater to professional, and I'm going to make chocolates for hotel, restaurant, cruise line, you know, whoever going to buy chocolates. That's what I start.
That's not an easy thing to do. It's an entrepreneurial venture. Were you scared? I mean, I know when I started Three Seas, I was terrified.
If you don't think too much about it, then you're not that scared because you don't know. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, what can happen? I fail, then I go back to a restaurant.
Right.
So I decide that I'm going to find a space. So I was, at that time, I was running. I was training for the marathon, and I ran for New York Marathon. But I passed through Dumbo and with a friend of mine who introduced me to Dumbo. And I'm thinking, you know what? This is a perfect place. It's pretty much run down. That was run down. Dumbo was not Dumbo of today. But it's close to Manhattan. Manhattan is just there. So I meet a gentleman called David Valentas, who own pretty much all Dumbo. And I tell him, you know, rent me a space. So he introduced me to a couple space, and we agree on a 5,000 square foot, 1,000 square foot basement, 4,000 on top space that was empty for the last 30 years, was completely run down. But I don't care. You know, I didn't realize how much work it will take. So I tell him, I want it. I rent it. So I rent that space, and then trouble starts.
Yeah, first of all, you're in Dumbo, which nobody knows.
Nobody knew Dumbo at that time. That was not even Dumbo.
What were you thinking?
I was not thinking. So I rent that space, and I ask a mechanical engineer and an architect to come and visit the space. They did. They come to me and they say, oh, you know, I don't know if you realize where you put your feet here, but you're going to take at least $600,000 to just clean that space and bring electricity and water. And they say, so what do you want to do? And I tell them that my budget was $120,000 to $150,000, my retirement. So they look at me and they left. They don't even say bye. They just left. So, you know, I was a little bit depressed. What do I do? And a friend of mine called me a couple of days later and told me, say, look, I heard that you want to build a space. I closed my restaurant at the beginning of the summer, because he was in Lake Placid and there was no job on the summer. He said, and all the way to fall, I have no job, so I can come and help you build. He said, I have some experience because I am that guy was doing tile. He said, I have some experience. I can bring one of my waiter. And with you, that's three people, we can build your place. Exactly, that was my reaction.
But it's like, what about the cash?
You know, I was rich, $120,000. So... And he told me, I have a truck. And that was the magic world. I said, you know what? You have a truck. Let's do it. So I find him a little place to stay in New York. And he came with his waiter and myself. And every day we start at Home Depot. I can tell you all the price of Home Depot and where everything is. And we start building the place. And it takes us 3 months. And in 3 months, we build the place in Dumbo. We build the manufacturer. And in 2 weeks, we build a store. I mean,
and there were at the time, let's sort of supply some context here. There weren't very many freestanding chocolate stores.
That was very few.
You were, you know, there were French chocolate stores. There was Teutscher's, which is Swiss, right?
Big company, yes.
Yeah, big
La Maison du Chocolat, yes.
Yeah. But you'd become a big deal. You'd become, in many ways, the first rock star pastry chef at Le Cirque. You won the Beard Award for Best Pastry Chef. You won every award.
I buy that one. I didn't want it. This one.
Well, I didn't know that you bought it. but it was a big deal. And to make this transition, to try to use what fame and renown that you developed and pour it into a chocolate shop in Dunbo where you don't have any money, to enough money to open the store, okay, that's a little crazy.
It was. And you know, I talked to a friend of mine. His name is Glendorf. He's a lawyer, very smart gentleman. And I freak him out. I saw him looking at me like, what's going on? Are you crazy? I mean, you're not even a chocolatier. You're a pastry chef. Nobody know you for chocolates. And I'm thinking, you know, I need a change. I'm unhappy now, so I need to be happy. So I'm going to make myself happy. I'm going to do something that make you happy. That make me happy, pardon. And I try. And after we build that place, after we build the store, we went through a lot of funny adventure doing it. And then we opened the store. And if I remember, in less than a week, I produced more revenue than what I invest in that little store. Not the manufacturer on the back, but the little store that I build. I make more revenue in less than a week. So that's when I say, you know what? It's working. I mean, I cannot believe it, but people was coming from Jersey, from New York City, from Brooklyn. People from Brooklyn was coming to me and say, thank you for opening in Brooklyn. And I was thanking them to buy my product. So I was maybe the first chef to move from Manhattan to Brooklyn. Today it's kind of fashionable.
Yes,
to move
sure.
from, you know, to go to Brooklyn and open something. But at that time, all my friends were telling me, you're gone. You history. It's
right.
Over for you.
So
you passed the bridge.
So you never had that moment that I had at Serious Eats and that most entrepreneurs have where like, what was I thinking? Nobody's coming through the door. You were pretty much, because I assume press and various other things, you were busy from day one?
And yes, I was on TV at the time. I had a TV show on TV Food Network, and prior to that, I was on PBS. So I was 5 years on TV. So people were seeing me on TV and come to the store the same afternoon.
Got it.
On Saturday morning, every Saturday morning when I opened my store, there was a line in front of the store. And my fear was not, are they going to like the product or am I going to have enough product? My fear was that they're going to leave. They're not going to buy anything. So I was running to the store, make some hot chocolates, go out with a bunch of cups and give hot chocolate for free to the whole line and tell people, we're going to do as fast as we can to serve you. So please be patient. And that was my fear because I was so embarrassed that people have to wait outside.
And then the hot chocolate became your signature item.
And the hot chocolate became, it's funny because people were sending me hot chocolates. This is for kids. And I was telling people, taste it. It's good. And what I mean is, it's strong enough, it's chocolatey enough that adults love it. And then hot chocolate start for me and people start to love the hot chocolates. Then I take a trip to Oaxaca, Titotilan exactly, next to Oaxaca. And I learn about chipotle chili and ancho chili. Chipotle was a spice at this time, not
right.
A restaurant.
So Mexican style hot chocolate.
Mexican style. So I did that too. And it became famous in my company. So I start to do the wicked hot chocolate and the classic hot chocolates. And I start not even selling it. I start just giving it to people because nobody want to buy that stuff. And now we sell quite a bit of it.
And do you think your chocolates were any good when you first started?
A lot of the chocolates actually that we made when I start, I still have them today on my counter. So the line was not complete as I have today, but it was quite a bit of those chocolates that we're still carrying today. Of course, I add to it.
Were they as good as you wanted them to be? Like, things usually take a while.
When I start my business, I was doing what I do for already 30 years.
Got it.
So I don't think that I had a secondary product. Maybe that was not exactly what I want, but it was pretty good. And again, there was pretty much no small maker in New York at that time. You know, those are fresh chocolates. You buy them, you eat them. You don't mm-hmm. sit on them. The best way to store chocolates that we make in a store like mine, the best way to store them is in your stomach because they don't age very well.
Right.
So eat them fresh.
What was your inspiration for both the chocolates and the hot chocolate, for that matter? Was it based on Café Angeline? Was it based on just your own head?
And you know, when look, everything, every piece of a story. Hot chocolates, I remember to ride motorcycle and bicycle, but mostly motorcycle, in the south of France during the winter. It's not cold there, but we don't dress very well. So we freeze during the winter because we don't dress well. So I remember to ride the motorcycle and to stop into those salons de thé and order a hot chocolate, because that's what you do. You cold, you stop in a good salon de thé and you order a hot chocolate. And that thing going to warm you up from the inside. And I still remember the richness of those hot chocolates. So when I had my store, I'm thinking, okay, I need to make a hot chocolate like I used to drink in the south of France. So I start to make the same hot chocolates that I have in my memory. And it's not for kids, it's actually for adults. And the bonbon of chocolates and every, you know, I make one bonbon as an example with almonds. And I call him, you know, Jacques Torres, because in Bandol we have almond tree. I love almonds. I remember that when I was a kid, my parents used to put fresh almonds from the tree that we have on the backyard on top of a wood-burning stove that we have. And then the almonds inside that start to roast, and then the whole house smell like almonds. So I decide that I'm going to make a chocolate that tastes like that. So I make a praliné with almonds and I make these chocolates. And I make a caramel and I make a chocolate with raspberry. And, you know, every piece had pretty much a backstory to it, or a raison d'être.
Right.
Why doing those products? And some product that I just love, I discover macadamia and I'm thinking, oh my God, this nut is so good. It's buttery, it's flavorful. So I start to make macadamia coated with milk chocolates. I caramelize them, I coat them with milk chocolate. We still do it. So every product that we made pretty much had a backbone, a backstory. That was a reason of doing it.
Got it. But you, at the time, you weren't making your own chocolate.
At that time in Brooklyn, you know, basically to make your own chocolates, you can make it in two ways. You can buy some pretty flimsy equipment and make a chocolate that's not really good, not really refined, not really good. Or you have to invest relatively heavily into equipment to make a really good chocolate. So until I was able to invest in it, I never attempt to make the chocolate. Remember, never settle for mediocrity. So I always tell myself that at least one time a day, never settle for mediocrity. So I decide that the day that I'm going to make the bean to bar, I will have the right equipment. And I can tell you today, I have the best equipment and maybe one of the best plantation today to make a good chocolate
bar. So you aren't going to do half-assed bean to bar.
I was refusing to do something and put it on the market just for having the bean to bar.
Got it.
I did it when I'm ready, when I can invest in it.
Got it. So we haven't even gotten to talk about what's involved in making your own bean to bar chocolate, the chocolate museum, your teaching career, or frankly, even taste some of your chocolate. So if you come back, will you bring some?
Of course I will.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for sharing at least part of your special sauce, Jacques Torres, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time. Merci beaucoup.